Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There is a moment here in the trial of Corey Richens that doesn't show up in the toxicology report. It doesn't appear in the financial records or the phone location data with a 6-page letter written from a jail cell. It happened about 2 weeks after Eric Richens died, when his wife met up with her boyfriend for the first time since his death. You know, that wonderful reunion that we see in all the Hallmark movies where the husband dies and then the wife reunites with her secret lover from the side. All those moments. According to Robert Josh Grossman's testimony, Corey Richens looked at him in the desert as they went off into the night to find a secret lookout to go make out by. I mean, well, they went out to the desert. It was described, I mean, to me, it kind of reminded me of Clark Griswold taking Rusty out to the desert. You ever see a grown man naked Rusty, that sort of thing? Except she asked the question, have you ever killed anyone when you were in Iraq? You know, like you do the first time you see your boyfriend after your husband dies. Asking this man that you're semi-remotely romantically involved with, or full-on romantically involved with, let's just be honest about it, while cheating on your now dead husband, have you ever killed anybody? It's a weird question to ask, especially when people are starting to look at you going, I wonder if she killed him. Interesting thing our minds do. Trying to find ways to process our decisions. I was going to say grief, but I don't know if it's grief that is what Corey is feeling right now, as it might be guilt or anxiety that she might be found out. So how did this person over here handle mentally the reality of what it's like to take another person's life? How did it make him feel? You know, kind of Koberger did the little survey of folks for a while there. When you committed your crime, how did it make you feel? Corey's trying to basically, if the prosecution is correct, get underneath the skin in a way of her being able to relate to him, to find her own roadmap of this is how human beings react to such actions. Because she doesn't seem to have the empathy part working very well in her brain. So she has to do the learned behavior thing and emulate and mimic others. He answered her. He's a veteran. He had taken lives overseas, and he told her. 1 month later, she texted him, I think I want you to be my husband one day. Ooh. That's where this story starts. It's not with the body discovered in the early morning hours of March 4th, 2022. Not with the autopsy or the fentanyl levels or the housekeeper who says she made 4 drug runs on Corey's behalf. It starts with that conversation. Because that conversation, it tells you something no spreadsheet can. It tells you about the interior of a person. Corey Richens has pled not guilty to all charges. She is presumed innocent under the law, as every defendant is, as she should be. What we're going to be getting through here. And again, we're recording this prior to the verdict. We're going to be getting through here is what the state presented to a jury over 3 weeks and 42 witnesses. Whether it was enough is the only question worth asking. Because there was no smoking gun. There was never going to be. What prosecutors built instead was a different kind of case, a portrait assembled from the hundreds of small, ugly details. None of them individually fatal. All of them collectively pointing in the same direction. Death by a thousand cuts. And by the time it was over, the defense had called zero witnesses to pull any of them out. Let's start with the trap that she was in. And as we do, I'd love to get your thoughts and your feedback in the description, or rather in the comment section of our YouTube channel or on our Substack. The links are in the description. Corey and Eric Richens lived near Park City, Utah. Ski country, money country, the kind of zip code where appearances are a full-time job. They had three kids and a house flipping business, and underneath all of it, a prenuptial agreement that prosecutors say turned their marriage into a locked room. Multiple witnesses testified that Corey told them she felt trapped, not just unhappy, trapped. That if she left, she walked away with nothing. One friend testified Corey told her she couldn't see any easy way forward out of the marriage. Then they said Corey told her it would be easier if Eric just died. In May of 21, nearly a year before Eric's death, Corey consulted a divorce attorney. She would apparently weigh her options and kept the marriage going. Her real estate company, K. Richens Realty, was meanwhile doing what a lot of ambition-fueled operations do when they grow too fast and not enough capital. It was collapsing. A forensic accountant testified that by the time Eric died, Corey was approximately $4.5 million in debt. There were 236 attempted overdraft transactions over roughly 14 months. That's, oh my God, almost one a day. Nearly 6,000 in fees from rejected transactions alone. The accountant's words were clinical and devastating. The business was collapsing. It had been collapsing. And but for a significant infusion of cash, would have continued to collapse. Prosecutors say she took out a $250,000 home equity line of credit using Eric's power of attorney without his knowledge, putting their family home on the line. She also took out multiple life insurance policies on Eric, totaling approximately $2 million. Also, according to prosecutors, without telling him. Here's the turn that prosecutors say she never anticipated. Eric had a trust. He met with an estate attorney. His sister was the beneficiary, not Corey. Corey didn't find out until the day after Eric died. And if the prosecution's theory is correct, she allegedly killed him for money she didn't even know she was going to get. That detail doesn't prove anything. It just sits there and it breathes. Now comes Carmen Lauber. Lauber was the family housekeeper for 9 years. She testified in early 2022. Corey called her and asked if she could reach out to someone for some pain medication for an investor, Corey said. Lauber testified she bought pills. Corey texted back that her investor wanted something stronger. So Lauber connected with a man named Robert Krauser, who said he had pills containing fentanyl. Lauber told Corey. Corey's response in a text message shown to the jury, okay, go ahead and get them. After that purchase, according to Lauber's testimony, Corey came back and asked for something stronger again. This cycle played out four times before Eric died, according to her account. Eventually asking for the Michael Jackson stuff. Wonder what that means. Separately, a witness named Anna Isabella testified that in January 22, she was with her husband when Corey called him, asking for a favor for a client. The words Corey allegedly used, the Michael Jackson drug. Yeah. So she asked for the Michael Jackson drug. It looks like more than once. She had a mission. She knew what she was going for. Not specifically the type, but she knew she wanted the effect. And when you ask for the Michael Jackson drug, and Michael Jackson, of course, as we all know, died of a drug overdose of propofol, not fentanyl. Corey doesn't do good with words. There's pretty much one meaning there. It's like saying, take me out the way Kennedy died. Nobody's thinking like that's just old age. It's like, I mean, take anything where somebody dies tragically and insert that into a sentence when you're referring to whatever it is that you want to get for another living human being. The connecting of the dots, it ain't hard. The only person who would want to make that hard or make that confusing, it's going to be the defense of Corey Richens. Might mean this. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Might now. And that's where we get to that reasonable part. When someone is asking for the Michael Jackson drug for their spouse, is it reasonable to think that it might be something other than a drug that could kill them? If your answer is no, then she's guilty. Someone's asking for the Michael Jackson drug for someone else. Is it reasonable to think that there's any other thing that they might be asking for other than a drug that could kill that person? I think, like I said, there's really only two roads here. Either yes, it is reasonable to think it's something else. And if you're answering yes, you don't know what happened to Michael Jackson. You are uninformed. It's not that there's a reasonable doubt there. You're just dumb or uninformed if you think there is another reasonable thing that she's not asking for Tic Tacs so her husband can go do the moonwalk. No, she's asking for a drug that killed one man, and she wants the same drug for her husband. That's how that's interpreted. There really is no other way around this one. It's pretty black and white. And that, again, going back to the word reasonable, is it reasonable to think there's anything else one would be asking for? No, there isn't. Could there be something else? Yes, anything is possible. But is it reasonable to think that? No. The defense attacked Lubbert with everything they had, and they had real material to work with. Some, or she changed her story in early interviews with investigators. She said nothing about fentanyl, then changed her account after detectives told her Eric had died from a fentanyl overdose. She was granted immunity for her cooperation. A video played in court showed an investigator saying, "Give us the details that will ensure Corey gets convicted of murder." That line dropped in the courtroom, and it stayed there. But the prosecution had a prior consistent statement, roughly 100 pages of a 1,000-page interview transcript that the judge allowed in to counter the inconsistency argument. And underneath all of Lubber's complications sat the toxicology. 5 times a lethal dose of fentanyl in Eric's blood, illicit synthetic. The medical examiner classified it not as pharmaceutical grade. When investigators went looking for Eric's prescription drug history, the foundation of the defense's theory that he was secretly sourcing his own pills, they found it was limited, sparse. The suggestion that Eric bought this or brought this on himself never had the evidence to support it. And if they had wanted to, there's a way they could have done that. Hair follicle testing. No one tested Eric's hair. Not the prosecution, not the defense. If we're truly trying to get to the truth, which I would think we would be doing, that test could have told us a lot. How? Hair follicles are like the rings of a tree. If you look at the rings of a tree, if you cut a tree, you can see what went on with that tree throughout the years. If there was damage, if there was this or that, if you know what to look for, you can see its history as it continues to grow. Same with hair follicles. If you test them, you can see through history what that person, in some instances, with certain substances, excuse me, was consuming. It would answer it either way. It's an answer that I don't know the defense wants. And I don't know it's one that the prosecution wants to roll the dice on, or the investigation was just not super competent, which we know that already. But if you were to look at the hair follicle test, and if you were to find that there's a history of fentanyl use, you would see it in the hair. You would. And if there was a prolonged pattern of use, well, there you go. The answer would be Eric was a regular user of the drug. Doesn't make Corey innocent, but it sure creates, say the words with me, reasonable doubt. So I'm curious. I mean, they did not pull this, but if Corey Richens wants to mount, if she's found guilty, an appeal at some point in time, that might be a newly found piece of evidence if they can exhume the body, if they can do the test. And if those results show that, if they don't, they may just further solidify exactly why everything looks so damning against her. Again, if she is convicted, we're still playing the if game here, because as of this recording, we don't have a verdict. We're sitting on the eve of closing arguments as we're recording this. Prosecutors charged not just murder, but attempted murder as well. And they say the first attempt came on Valentine's Day, a sandwich allegedly left in Eric's truck along with a love note. Eric reportedly broke out in hives and blacked out. After that, according to Lauber's testimony, Corey came back and asked for something stronger. If you're a juror absorbing that sequence, the night of March 4th stops being an isolated event and becomes the second attempt by someone who learned from the first one and adjusted. And now comes the part that doesn't have an innocent explanation anyone presented in the courtroom. Digital forensics testimony established that hundreds of text messages and call logs were deleted from Corey's phone between January and March 22, the exact window of the alleged drug procurement and the death. She switched to a new phone in April of 22, the month after Eric died. The deletion of large chunks of messages was specific to that original device and that specific time frame. Her phone also contained searches conducted before her arrest, fentanyl poisoning, death benefit insurance payouts, and deleting iPhone messages. Those three searches from a triangle, the method, the money, the cleanup. After her arrest, investigators found additional searches. Women, Utah prisons, luxury prisons for the rich, America. Can cops force you to do a lie detector test? Those are not the search history of a grieving widow trying to understand what happened to her husband. Then there is the letter. Oh, the letter. That pesky letter. In 2023, while she was in jail awaiting trial, investigators recovered a six-page letter written by Corey that prosecutors labeled evidence of consciousness of guilt. In it, she directed her brother to tell her former attorney that Eric had confided in him about getting pain pills and fentanyl from Mexico, that he just gets high every night. The letter included the line, "The connection has to be made with Mexico and drugs. It can be short and to the point, but it has to be done." She was in jail facing a murder charge, and she was still writing the script. The defense said it was fiction. The manuscript she was working on separately, she also texted her brother asking if Eric had mentioned suicide. He said no. Children's book. Let's talk about that. In the months after Eric's death, Corey promoted a self-published grief book called Are You With Me? Story about a father with angel wings watching over his young son. She pitched herself to a local morning show as the author, appeared on camera, told producers it was the first children's book about losing a parent. Investigators testified she paid a ghostwriting company to write it, so she didn't even write it. It was in preparation for the future. She wasn't the author of the book about her dead husband. She was the client. After her arrest, her own mother anonymously mailed a copy to the sheriff's office with a note. "There are two sides to every story. This is the true Corey. I'm her mother. You should believe me." That part she didn't add, but "This is the true Corey" is where it ended. Telling you. Dig there. I don't know what's there. I'm not saying her mother has anything to do with this. I'm saying there might be some interesting text messages. If they've not already been deleted, I'm sure they have. But considering the absolute shit job the investigation actually did on this, I would venture to guess there might be some other interesting folks in this circle that may have had some influence on Corey in ways that we are unaware of, that they are sitting off to the sidelines right now going, thank God they didn't see that. Again, my conjecture, I have no idea. And in no way, shape, or form am I saying Corey's mother has anything to do with this whatsoever. I'm just saying there might be some really interesting messages there. Really interesting. Considering she's doing this. Investigators trace the Amazon account back to Corey's mother. If you're being honest about what the whole picture looks like, the TV appearance, the ghostwriting authorship, the anonymous package, your mom, the book reads less like a grief product, more like a reputation management exercise. And oh yeah, mom's previous partner from years ago also died of a drug overdose. Oh! Odds there, not super great, but possible, yeah. Reasonably possible? Oh, maybe. Overdoses are certainly a thing. People who are mixed up in that world, if you tend to travel in that world, you may have more than one person around you that's OD'd and not come back. If they OD'd. That's the question. That's the official story. And of course, again, no one's been charged with anything in that case whatsoever. Her attorney even said that's ridiculous to insinuate otherwise. We're not insinuating otherwise. I'm just pointing out history. Little nuggets along the timeline of history of this family where you go, that's a little weird that you have that. But again, if you run with folks that are in that world, you never know. And that's the honest to God truth. You never know. I mean, but it certainly does raise an eyebrow. Which brings us back to Grossman. His testimony doesn't end with the did you ever kill anybody question. He testified that it was watching Corey go on that local morning show to promote the book, performing the grieving author, the devoted mother, that something finally shifted in him, started looking backward at everything. He said when a private investigator hired by Eric's family told him what investigators believe, he was, in his own words, blown away. And then looking at everything in our past through a different set of goggles. The man who loved her, who cried on the stand while their text messages were read aloud in a courtroom, who had believed she loved him too, looking back at every conversation, every moment, trying to figure out if she did it. That's what the state put in front of 12 jurors. 42 witnesses, 3 weeks of testimony. The defense called none. Corey waived her right to testify. The judge denied every motion for a direct verdict. On all five counts, the case went to the jury whole. The defense's argument was not irrational. They pointed to what prosecutors could not prove, where exactly the fentanyl came from, how it physically entered Eric's body, the absence of drugs ever found in the home. They hammered Labra's credibility at every opportunity. Their core position was direct. The state was asking the jury to convict based on reasons, not proof. They're going to spend weeks trying to convince you Corey had reasons to kill her husband just because they can't show you that she did. That is a coherent legal argument. Motive is not evidence of the act. Suspicion is not proof. Circumstantial cases require the jury to connect dots they didn't watch being drawn in real time. And yet the debt, the prenup trap, the drug procurement, escalating specific documented texts, the Valentine's Day attempt, the deleted messages, the pre-arrest searches, the letter from jail, coaching witnesses, the ghost-written grief book, and the morning show appearance, the question she asked her boyfriend about what it feels like to kill someone. Any one of those things, you can explain away. Two of them, maybe. All of them together in sequence, building the same direction, with no counter-narrative ever put before the jury, that's a different problem. Whatever verdict will come out of this jury room, this is the evidence they have. Courts convict on circumstantial cases every single day. They also acquit on them. The law doesn't grade the elegance of the evidence. It asks one question: did the state prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? That answer belongs to 12 people who will sit in the courtroom and hear all of it, every word, every cut. And there are a lot of cuts. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. Love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue our conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts as well, so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases we follow for you right here. All right. Wherever you do that, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, thank you very much. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.